Okay, April 30th, 2010, Soho Ladies Meeting 2. I just came to the ladies meeting downstairs.
Did you record that too?
Yes.
My difficulty is that you can, there is a spiritual environment, but they need some emotional support or something. So if you can tell something about that.
What do you mean?
What, like, how you can help a lady who's coming and living in the ashram, how you can, like, how you can really help someone who's doing that choice.
I think women have a need for bonding and sharing and emotional support to give that to each other. Of course, everyone's different, though. Everyone's an individual.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can say that as a general rule, but everyone's individual. Most of you take care of people by getting to know them as people and seeing what each person needs to be happy. Which what some one person needs may be a little different from what you need. Being willing to do that. Sometimes it means spending a lot of time with somebody. Like I say, everybody's different. Some people we all have essentially the same needs, but some of us have certain needs greater than others. And sometimes they manifest differently in different people. Reading that one of the main ways that a volunteer program is successful is if there's a good match made between the volunteer and the work that they're doing. Because people have different reasons for volunteering. Some people volunteer because they're lonely and they want to be with other people. And then if you just give them a job off in an office by themselves, they probably won't volunteer again. So part of taking care of people is seeing what kind of person they are, what's motivating them. And then giving them what they need in Krishna's service. As far as you can. Is that okay?
Yes.
Anybody else have anything else they want to talk about?
I think because I spoke to you before about that, and I just feel like it's practical advice that I'd like that you asked to give us who live in the ashram. How can we get really serious about studying Prabhupada's books, living in the ashram? Because, you know, living in the ashram, we have a number of hours of service to do every day.
I have found that an ashram is usually the worst place to study Prabhupada's books. Sorry. That has been my experience. My experience is that living in an ashram is probably the worst environment to do a detailed study of Prabhupada's books. And I had times when I lived in an ashram that I didn't pick up a book other than the classes. Work, 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 work. Do this, now do this, now do this, now do this, now do this.
What advice would you give for people who would like to stay in the ashram for some time?
Hide on the fire escape sometimes. That's what I used to do. Just to hide on the fire escape to read. But I get a lot more reading done as a grihasta living outside than I ever got done in an ashram. Well, with one in a Boston ashram. But I was already a householder. I had a baby. I can't remember an ashram situation where I got a lot of reading done. Classes, maybe? Have organized classes that gets approved by the temple management? organized study system, where that's what you're supposed to be doing at that time, so you don't, so nobody can say, oh, can you transfer the offering? Oh, can you do this? Oh, can you do this? I'm sorry, we have our study time at this time. I mean, maybe that won't even work. Try that. Every Tuesday and Thursday from 3 to 4 or something. You know. Start a Bhakti Shastri program. Make it something official. So that everybody feels that they need to come and they need to study. There are a lot of classes here, aren't there? Three classes a day in the temple? That's there.
I heard someone said if you go to all your classes, then there's a lesser need to read the books because you're reading, hearing from the ones that you need to hear from at class.
As I said, in most ashrams, there's not a whole lot of time for personal study. You'd have to be in an ashram where the leaders were really, really into personal study. If temples got too much into that, Prabhupada would stop it. There were temples where there was lots and lots of classes and lots of personal study time, Prabhupada would actually stop it. Sorry. If you want to really get deep into personal study, you probably have to take a break and go to the VIHE or the MI or something like that. Take a course. My times of in-depth study was when I had my first baby. I was reading Prabhupada's books 4 to 6 hours a day, every day. When I'm teaching Shastra, so I spent 15, 16 years teaching Bhakti Shastra. Or if I'm in a retreat kind of situation. Otherwise, when I'm traveling and preaching like this, I'm reading a little bit every day. But it's not so intense. If you have, like David Mittemarsh, he has a program where his disciples, I think, have to read 2 hours a day or something like that. It's either 1 or 2 hours a day. So if you stay in those ashrams, that's part of the program. I haven't stayed over. I've gone to their retreats. But I used to give a lot of classes at his ladies' ashrams in New Zealand, and that's integrated into their program. So you could integrate it into the program, but you'd have to have support from the leadership to do that. You'd have to have leadership that felt that having, you know, half an hour to an hour to 2 hours of study time every day was important. Does that make sense? One thing that I've learned is that every individual has strengths and weaknesses. You will not find any individual other than God who has only strengths. Even Bhima, and if you look at Bhima and Yudhisthira, who are both pure devotees. Yudhisthira's forgiveness was his strength and it was also his weakness. So whenever you have, whoever is the leader in a particular temple or project of any kind, the leader in a school, in a temple, any project, the leader of a project, their strengths and weaknesses will be reflected in the project. You will not have any project also that has only strengths and no weaknesses. It doesn't exist. And one way to get around that, to some extent, never get around it completely, is if there's a lot of people involved in the management. Like Bhaktivedanta Manor is so big with so many different aspects to the management that it's almost like there's many different temples there, isn't it? You know, you can go be involved in different projects, and each of those projects have a mood So if you're involved in the Goshala, you're involved in the store, you're involved in the theater, you're involved in the, right? Isn't it? There's different managers. And their mood affects their particular area. But the manor is an unusual temple, that it's big and varied. Most temples, the main manager is just going to affect. So what the manager considers important is what people are going to do a lot of, and what the manager considers medium important, people are going to do a medium amount of. What the managers consider less important, people are going to do less of. And there's not really a way to get around that. Now, of course, you're the manager of the ladies' ashram, so you also have some influence in the ladies' ashram. If your strengths and weaknesses are radically different from the temple, other temple leaders, that's going to be a problem. But if it's somewhat different, you can also influence what happens in ladies' ashram. And you are influencing. You're influencing right now. It's always like that. You're always influencing. If you're a musician, then everybody, all the women would probably be getting, you know, opportunity for music lessons. Seriously. If you're into study and scholarship, then there'd be studying going on. Whatever the leaders are, I really realized this when I spent a year as an assistant manager in a public school, a government school in America, as part of my studies. And they had an incredible music program for those kids. Amazing. The music teacher in that school was arguably one of the best teachers in the school. And he had a lot of power in the management of the school, too. He wasn't only a music teacher. Music was such a big part of that school. A lot of the kids were learning at a primary school. You know, everybody had to take music classes, but a lot of the kids were studying individual instruments. There were music clubs after school. There were lots of musical performances. Now, there were art classes because they were required by the government, but there wasn't so much there. And very few of the kids were learning how to do public speaking. That wasn't part of the curriculum at all. It just wasn't there. In my school, all the kids learned how to do public speaking, and they were all writing. Kids from the age of 5 were doing public speaking. But we didn't even have a music class. And if someone said to me, Ermila, don't you think you should have a music class in your school? I would say, yeah, that'd be a really good idea. If you could find a teacher, we'll do it. But I never made a big effort to find a teacher. And it wasn't until I worked in that other school that I realized, wow, my kids really missed out. And then I saw, you know, my school, I'm talking academically, my school had strengths that this school lacks. And this school has strengths that my school lacked. And it depended on the leader. And it's almost impossible to force yourself to think that something's important that you don't really think is important. Because each of us only has so much energy. Each of us is apportioning our energy. I can't give an equal and full amount of energy to everything. Impossible. Can't do it. So I've been in some temples where personal sadhana is really emphasized. Some temples where preaching and book distribution is really emphasized. Some where private study is really emphasized. Some where doing home programs and preaching to the congregation is really emphasized. And there's usually 2 or 3 things that are really emphasized, and then another whole bunch of things that are medium emphasized, and then there's some things that just nobody talks about, nobody does, it just doesn't happen. So you want to look at what's the mood of the leaders, what are they emphasizing? Can we have more of a study program fit into their mood? Is that part of their mood? And then you have to also look honestly at yourself, is it your mood? How important is it to you? How much are you willing to shuffle things around? How much are you willing to take energy away from other things? Because we have all a limited amount of energy. What are you willing to take energy away from to put into having a study program? How much energy are you willing to put into maintaining it? To making sure that there's facility, that there's a time that is protected. there was a time that personal study was a very high priority here in Wisconsin. And I know that because I give classes here. And wherever I give classes, I always ask questions from the books. You notice that I do that?
Mm-hmm.
One of the, there's several reasons why I do that, but one of the reasons that I do that is to try to give people impetus to study. So in different temples, I see how many people can answer my questions. In some places I go, nobody can answer any questions. Okay, where are the two places in the Bhagavad Gita where Krishna asks, what's the symptoms of a self-realized soul? And people just look at me, huh? And everyone in the audience just goes, huh? Usually there's one or two people. I mean, I remember here when everybody knew that kind of thing. There was a time like that. And Soho was one of the top places where I knew that any Shastra question I asked, the majority of the devotees would know the answer.
Is sadhana like bulk, does it come to a bit of a halt if you don't read so much?
Each of us has a limited amount of energy, and we have to decide where to put our energy. Prabhupada says in the ultimate issue, hearing, chanting, remembering, serving are all the same. That dividing them up into different categories is doesn't really operate on higher levels of advancement.
So if
I would say that hearing is very, very, very important for spiritual life. How you hear, when you hear, to what degree you hear, what you hear, that's going to vary so much from one situation to another. And what's ideal for one person is not ideal for somebody else.
So if someone's not a big reader, or like me, doesn't remember what they read, it's not so bad.
Do you have a Bhagavad Gita here? Sorry, Bhagavad Gita handy.
Mm-hmm.
It's over there.
Oh, yeah. Right behind you. Right in here.
In here. Look, I got something.
I personally am a steady reading nut. I could read for 14 hours a day and I wouldn't get tired. I love studying. I love reading.
But what's the difference between study and reading?
For me, studying means I'm probably going to teach it. Reading means I'm having fun. That's for me. For
what
me.
Studying
for me. Studying means probably for me that I'm going to teach it. And reading means I'm having fun.
You're going to teach it.
I'm going
teach.
To teach it.
Teach.
Teach. Teach. Teach. If you say to me, Urmila, I'd like you to teach the 10th chapter of Bhagavad Gita tomorrow, then tonight I will study the 10th chapter. That's Urmila's definition. It's not dictionary definition. It's Urmila's definition. A person may have a bona fide spirit. Oh, wait. No, that's not the one I'm looking for here. Previously. It's up here. Oh, here we go. Yeah, it is in this purple. Sometimes Mayavadi philosophers criticize the devotees because they think that most of the devotees are in the darkness of ignorance and are philosophically naive sentimentalists. Actually, that's not a fact. There are very, very learned scholars who have put forward the philosophy of devotion. But even if a devotee does not take advantage of their literature or of his spiritual master, if he is sincere in his devotional service, he is helped by Krishna himself within his heart. So the sincere devotee engaged in Krishna consciousness cannot be without knowledge. The only qualification is that one carry out devotional service in full Krishna consciousness. if you can read Prabhupada's books, that's better. Okay? My suggestion in general is that you should read Prabhupada's books and you should listen to Prabhupada's lectures and you should do both of those regularly. That's my general suggestion. That you should regularly be listening to Prabhupada's lectures and conversations and regularly be reading Prabhupada's books, those two things. Because Prabhupada's lectures and Prabhupada's books are a little different. Prabhupada's books cover things that Prabhupada never discusses in his lectures or hardly discusses in his lectures. Prabhupada goes into much more elevated topics in his purports. I mean, he may touch on them in a lecture, but detail in the purports is much more. And Prabhupada's lectures are much more general preaching. The mood is a little different in the purports and the lectures. So if you get both, then you're really getting the whole picture, and then you're associating with Srila Prabhupada. And Rupa Goswami says the qualification for performing Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti is faith in the scriptures, because Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti is based on the scriptures. Well, if you don't know the scriptures, how are you going to have faith in the scriptures? It's going to be pretty hard. But Prabhupada's saying, yeah. If you're doing devotional service, even if you're not taking advantage of the literatures, Krishna will help you from within your heart.
I think it was 1 year or a little bit earlier, I don't remember when you was. I was studying Bhakti Shastri Manor, you were giving on third chapter one lecture, one like class, and you were having this list about modes, three modes, and how they are also different to all those Vata, Pitta. And it is very interesting for me because I mean, I don't know myself what mode I am in. Maybe all in the one, I don't know. But just in general, I see that sometimes devotees, just because person is very, very active, they think it's a mode of passion. But you gave very much point that Vata in mode of goodness, it's the same, almost the same qualities as Pitta in mode of passion. So there is completely, and then it made me to think that actually to see someone's mode, it's a motivation, because goodness is there. And so if you could maybe elaborate a little bit more about that, and also to say how much is important to know for, let's say, me, what mode I am. Am I Vata, Pitta, or what? How important it is, to what stage I need to... Because for me, sometimes it's interesting to see, oh, my nose is Vata, nice. It's so funny.
I don't think you need to understand at that level.
And because you are with Vata, you don't have to eat cabbage, you know. So, but anyway, how important is to know that, and how modes interact with these
things. Okay, two separate things, and each of them are important to know. It's important to know something about what sort of nature you have in this life. Now, whether you know it at that level of detail and with that level of sophisticated Ayurvedic terminology, but at least you should know what are you good at and what do you like to do? What gives you energy? You should know that. That's very useful information. As a result of our past desires and activities, we have a particular kind of vehicle. It's awfully good to know what kind of vehicle you have. If you're sitting in a vehicle, it's nice to know how it works. Useful information. It's nice to know, am I in a bicycle, a motorcycle, a car, a bus, a truck, a boat, or a plane? That's useful information. I don't necessarily have to know exactly how the carburetor works in the car that I'm driving, but I at least need to know, is it a car or a motorcycle or a bicycle? I mean, I should have some idea. Is it a boat? You know, what's it capable of doing? If you try to drive your boat on land, it's going to be a little hard. Right? If you try to drive your car on the English Channel, it's going to be a little tough. So you should have some reasonable idea of what your nature is. And that you can look at, you know, what am I good at? What do I enjoy? What gives me energy? I mean, we all have certain things that if we're doing those things, we don't feel tired. We feel energized, actually. And even after 10, 12, 14 hours of doing that kind of work, we feel energized. We're sorry that we have to go to bed. We're sorry we have to stop. It's like the work gives us life. And there's other kinds of things that we do, it's just the opposite. I mean, some things are sort of in the middle where it's sort of, you know, we're sort of neutral about it. And then there are other things that are draining that we do, then we just feel like we're losing our energy and exhausted. And after 2 hours of doing them, we want to take a break and do something else, and driving us crazy. So that gives you some idea of what is your nature. Now, sometimes you can't tell what your nature is without some training. Sometimes there's something we think we're not good at or we don't enjoy because we haven't gotten the training how to do it properly. So if you're doing something wrong, you may think that you don't like it. So sometimes it's a question of training. At least you should know that much. And that's something about your personality, what kind of personality we have in this life. It's not our eternal personality. We should know something about what kind of personality we have. Do we like to be a leader and an organizer, or do we want to be a team player? Do we like being up on a stage in front of 10,000 people, or would we rather that nobody ever calls on us in class and says our name? What kind of personality do we have? Do we like big picture work or detail work? Do we like working a lot with other people, or do we like working on projects? Are we people who really need to take our time? I mean, one of my friends, who's a very wonderful artist, she would make garlands, and it would take her, I don't know, an hour and a half or 2 hours to make a garland. I make a garland in 15 to 20 minutes. And she would take each flower, and she'd look at it. She'd kind of open the petals, arrange it. She'd make sure there was no stem on the back. And she'd kind of look at it. Put it on. And she'd arrange it again. And so she made a garland. She did beautiful. She does traditional Rajasthani art, very fine, fine, fine art. And when she cleaned the temple room also, I mean, it would take her a long time. But the temple room was really clean when she was done, you know, and she'd really get everywhere. So are you a detail person? Are you a detail, careful, take a long time person? Or, you know, like me, I'm just like, okay, 15 minutes, just do the garland. And this flower's on crooked and that, well, it's all right, I got it done. You know, that's... So I'll get 10 times more things done than that other woman, but she'll get them done 10 times better than I will. So you have to know those kind of things about yourself. I shouldn't be proofreading someone else's work. That's not a good job for me. I should do the work and then someone else should check it. Because I'm going to make mistakes. You have to know something about yourself. What do you like? And the second thing that to know is whether you're doing things in the three modes or transcendentally. So you can be a careful person in the mode of ignorance, a careful person in the mode of passion, a careful person in the mode of goodness, or you can be a transcendentally careful person. Right?
Everybody knows that.
Well, are you very carefully figuring out how you're going to get your drugs today, or are you very carefully figuring out how you're going to work hard and make a lot of money and have a good reputation in the world? Are you very carefully figuring out how you're going to study philosophy? Are you very carefully thinking about how you're going to serve Krishna? That's pretty simple. That's not difficult. Mode of ignorance means the activities and the motive are bad. Mode of passion means the activities are probably good, but the motive is bad. Mode of goodness is the activities and the motive are both good. And transcendental is I'm doing things because I love Krishna. Motive and the mode of goodness is for liberation or for truth. Motivation and mode of passion is for honor. Person in the mode of passion does righteous things, but for the purpose of honor and status and prestige. And the person in the mode of ignorance does nasty things just for no reason, or to harm people, or... So am I doing pious things or impious things? That's the first question. Am I using my nature to do good things or bad things? If you're using your nature to do bad things, that's mode of ignorance. If you're using your nature to do good things, then that's passion, goodness, or transcendence. Now, what's driving me? Am I being driven by reputation and honor and prestige and status? And that's passion. Am I being driven by truth, by a desire for liberation, by a desire for heavenly enjoyment? That's goodness. Am I being driven by a desire for love and service? That's transcendence. So first you've got to figure out what kind of vehicle you have, and then you've got to figure out how you're using it. Okay, I got a bicycle. All right, am I using it to run people over? You know, what am I doing with it? Am I using it to pedal to the river so I can catch fish? You know, what am I doing with it? If I'm using it for a good purpose, then what's motivating me? What's driving me? Those things you should be aware of. Not that you should have to be aware of them every day or every minute or every week, but at least a few times a year you should assess, am I happy with what I'm doing? Do I feel enlivened by what I'm doing? Is it enlivening me? Do I feel energized, or do I just feel tired? At least like four times a year you should ask yourself that question. Am I energized? If you're feeling energized, then you're in the right environment. You're getting the right food. And if you're just, if you're feeling, oh, it's just, okay, I gotta go do my service. Oh, I don't have to, just wish I did. Then this, you're not using your vehicle in the right way. You're trying to drive your car in the water.
Is it more purifying to be doing?
No.
Okay.
Absolutely not. At least not according to God.
But isn't it that sometimes they may say, oh, you are just so much motivated that you want to do only what you like. And,
well, nobody can do only what they like. There's nobody in the world.
You have to surrender and do what you need.
Well, okay,
needed.
But that's true for everybody. I don't care who you are, whether you're a devotee or you're not a devotee. Sometimes everyone's got to do things that they're not good at and they don't like. Prabhupada says there's ordinary duties, desired activities, and emergency duties. Emergency duties means you're doing something you're not good at, you don't like. So everyone's got to do some emergency duties sometime. It's just life. But that emergency should be an emergency. It shouldn't be if it's regular, then it's starting to become your ordinary duties and it's not an emergency anymore. And there's parts of things that are our nature that we don't like. If you're situated in service that's according to your nature, it's not that you're going to like every single aspect of that service. There's going to be boring or difficult parts of it. Krishna says every endeavor is covered with fault, like smoke is covering fire. There's going to be some parts. You know, no matter how much you like taking care of a baby, you probably don't like cleaning up their vomit. It just probably, that part isn't fun. You know, it's always like that. And this book project I'm working on, at one point, my layout person got sick and I had to do all the, and he didn't, by the time I realized that he wasn't going to be able to do the work, there wasn't enough time to do it properly, and I had to put in like 5, you know, 16, 18 hour days of doing something that I had very little experience with and very little knowledge about. I was using, he had already started it in a certain program that I had never used before. I didn't know how to use it. I didn't have any time to get training. And a lot of it was just copy-paste, 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 copy-paste. Oh, it was a few days. And I was putting in something like 18-hour days. So that was not fun. I couldn't keep doing that. So I was enlivened by the overall project, but that particular aspect of it, I didn't like it at all. And one thing that I have to do is I have to bug people. You know, I have to go to the artists. Okay, you've got the deadline, it's not done yet. You know, what? I don't like doing it. I love working with the artists, and I love getting the artwork, and but I don't like bothering them. When is it going to get? I hate doing that. I really don't like doing it. I'll put it off and put it off and put it off and put it off. I don't like doing it. What I've done now is I've gotten other people to manage a lot of that stuff, so I don't have to do that. Because it, all of a sudden, instead of managing 10 people, it became managing 50 or 60 people like that. And I just said, I can't do that. That's not me. But in anything you do, there's going to be, A, some parts of it that are not pleasant. It's not that every part of something is going to be pleasant. And B, there's always going to be some things in life we don't like to do. But the main thing that we're doing should be things that are in accord with our nature and that we enjoy and give us energy. And Krishna's definition of surrender is do your nature for him. That's Krishna's definition of surrender. So if someone else has another definition of surrender, they should be able to back it up with Shastra, because in fact Krishna says you can't give up your nature. He says you can't. Those persons who execute their duties, according to my injunctions, and who follow this teaching faithfully, without envy, become free from the bondage of fruitive actions. But those who, out of envy, disregard these teachings and do not follow them regularly, are to be considered bereft of all knowledge, befooled, and ruined in their endeavors for perfection. So here Krishna is saying, if you act according to my instructions, you get all success, and if you don't, you're ruined. Even a man of knowledge acts according to his own nature. For everyone follows the nature he has acquired from the three modes. What can repression accomplish? He says, you're going to follow your nature. What's your choice? Follow your nature under my instructions, or follow your nature opposed to my instructions? That's the choice. There is not a choice of follow your nature or don't follow your nature. That option is not available. You can't. Your nature will reassert itself. Now, if anything that's important, a teacher will repeat, right? Right? If something's important, a teacher repeats it. So there aren't too many things that Krishna just repeats in the Bhagavad Gita, but that's one of them. It says the same thing. You know, and this is in the summary. This is in the 18th chapter. So this is where the other one was in the 3rd chapter. And here in the 18th chapter, Krishna is summarizing all of his instructions in the Bhagavad Gita. So it's a summary of everything. He's going to put the most important things there. And he's repeating this almost verbatim of what he said in the 3rd chapter. And it's at the very end of the 18th chapter. And you always put the most important things at the end, because people often only remember the things you say at the end. In all such activities, depend upon me and work always under my protection. In such devotional service, be fully conscious of me. If you become conscious of me, you will pass over all the obstacles of conditioned life by my grace. If, however, you do not work in such consciousness, but act through false ego, not hearing me, you will be lost. So again, this is the choice. Act in consciousness of Krishna, or act out of false ego. If you do not act according to my direction, do not fight, then you will be falsely directed. By your nature, you will have to be engaged in warfare. Under illusion, you are now declining to act according to my direction, but compelled by the work born of your own nature, you will act the same, O son of Kunti. So he's saying the same point. He says, you have a nature, you're going to follow your nature, you can't give up your nature, your choice is do it for Krishna or do it for Maya, that's your choice. So surrender means, and you know, suppose you're running a business. Do you want to have your employees do things they're good at and they enjoy, or do you want them to do things they're bad at and they don't enjoy? That's just logical. Do you want your employees to enjoy their work?
Yes.
Yeah, why?
They're happy.
Why do you care?
More productive.
They'll be more productive. Suppose you don't even care about them. All you care about is making
the
money.
The work is then better.
The work would be done. Yeah, suppose all you care about is making money. You don't give one fig about your employees. All you care about is the money. Will you engage your employees in doing things where they're happy? Yeah. Of course you would. And would you engage them in doing things they're good at?
Yes.
Of course. course you would. And you're just a selfish, greedy person. Now, there might be some times when you might go to an employee and say, listen, there's an emergency and I need to ask you to do this. And if you're really loyal to the company, you'll do it. But if you're a good employer, you won't do that very often, now, will you? If you're a good employer, it will be very rare that you ask your employees to do something that's against their nature. You'd only do that in an emergency. You do it with great regret. Because it's not good for them or for your company. So what does surrender mean? I'm doing my work for the benefit of the company. And not surrender means I'm doing my work so that I can get glorified. I'm keeping the secret list of my customers so I can leave the company and start my own business with the company's customer list. I'm stealing the company's pens when they're not looking. So that's what Krishna's saying. You get it, we have our nature. We have a particular vehicle. It's going to act in a particular way. That's it. There's good things about the nature we have in this life. There's bad things about the nature we have in this life. Oh, well. Don't waste your time envying somebody else's nature. Then you'll just get another body. You can try out their nature. Whatever nature we have in this life, use it for Krishna. So two things we should be asking ourselves. What nature do I have? And that some of that changes over life. So there's varnas and ashrams. Varna stays, your varna is steady for your whole life and your ashram changes over life.
So, like what I understand for all this, what you have said is that the main thing also, how can we ensure that we act according to our nature, that it does not drain us, but it gives
it
us energy,
yes,
it enlivens us. So no, there is no like really, really formula. You
that's a formula.
Have
that's a good
yeah,
formula.
That's the only formula we can act.
There's other formulas. That's the simplest one. There's others. You could go to an Ayurvedic doctor, an astrologer, and have them look at your chart and take your pulse and do an analysis. And I'm sure that it wasn't that long ago that's how a person's nature was determined. That a person went to school and their guru at school was also an expert in astrology and in Ayurveda and determined their nature and then trained them accordingly. Because, as I said in the beginning, that sometimes you can't tell what your nature is except by training. If you don't know how to do something, then even if that something would normally energize you, because you don't know how to do it, it doesn't. It's like if I don't know how to put the plug into the wall, even though it may fit, sometimes you try to put together some machine. And there may be two parts that fit together, but you don't know how to put them together. So you think they don't fit together. Have you ever had that? You know, you think that it doesn't work. There's some secret. You have to push some button here or something. So there may be, I've seen this in my own life, there were things I thought that I didn't like and I wasn't good at, and then when I met somebody who trained me in that area, I found out I liked it very much and I was very good at it. So ideally, there's a guru who, when you're a young child, sees what your nature is and gives you training when you're young, so that you automatically have the ability to work according to your nature. So that complicates things, because we're adults and we often don't know what our nature is. And it's hard. What are you going to do? You know, try to get training in 1,000 different things to see what fits. It's tough. You know, it's a tough thing. It's a tough situation. And one of the things that I would suggest is look at pieces of things. Instead of thinking, do I really like a whole activity, think about in its component parts. Do I like things that require detail work or big picture work? Do I like things where I'm working with people or where I'm doing projects? Which do I like more, if I had to choose? Do I like things where I'm at the front or where I'm at the back? Do I like things that involve a lot of mental and intellectual challenge, or do I like things that are simple and repetitive? Do I like things that involve a lot of creativity? Do I like working in part of a team? Do I like working on my own? I mean, you can ask those sort of questions. That will give you some idea. Does that help?
Mm-hmm.
And then the other question is, am I doing it for Krishna or am I doing it for my false ego? And if you answer that question honestly, you'll probably see that it's mixed. Well, if it isn't mixed, if you're doing it purely for Krishna, you'll be floating in an unlimited ocean of ecstasy 24 hours a day. So if you're not floating in an unlimited ocean of ecstasy 24 hours a day, then the motives must be mixed. No? And then you gradually work on, ask Krishna to help you work on the motives. One mistake people make is that surrender means doing something I'm bad at or I hate. And the more I hate something and the worse I am at it, the more surrendered I am. Which, if you think about it deeply, is a very strange concept. But I've heard this all over the world from so many people. That if I'm good at it and I like it, it must be Maya. I don't know what kind of God they think we're serving, but he must be pretty mean then. You know? Surrender means you have to be miserable. No wonder we don't want to surrender. So that's one misconception. And then another misconception is, okay, I start to realize that my motives for my actions are selfish, so let me stop my actions. That was what Arjuna said. Arjuna said, I can see that I'm fighting this war to win a kingdom, so I'll stop fighting the war. Krishna says, no, keep fighting the war, just change your motives. He said, you can't stop fighting it anyway. That's your nature. I'm driving this boat for selfish purposes. Okay, I won't take the boat on the water anymore. Well, what else are you going to do with it? Fly with it? You know, it's going to go on the water. That's where it belongs. Anything else is going to break it. So that's our other reaction. All of a sudden you see, oh my God, the only reason I'm doing this activity is so that people will praise me, or the only reason I'm doing this activity is so I'll get a place to sleep and something to eat. The only reason I'm doing this activity is out of envy, because I want to show I'm better than everybody else. And you'll start seeing that as you chant Hare Krishna. And then you might think, well, I guess I should stop doing this. Let me stop distributing books, because the only reason I'm going on book distribution is so I can distribute more books than anybody else and everybody can praise my name in the temple. So let me stop. No, don't stop. You change your motive. You start saying, Krishna, help me change my motive. Help me change why I'm doing this. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Now, it's not something we should be thinking about all the time. What we should be thinking about all the time is, how can I please Krishna? How can I please Guru? How can I Krishna on the movement? How can I do what I'm doing to the best of my ability? How can I really look at what I'm doing and really do it first class? That's what we should be thinking about all the time. And every once in a while, we should stop and evaluate. Am I doing something that's my nature, and what's my motives for doing it? And every once in a while, Krishna in your heart will also just say, by the way, your motives for doing this stink. Doesn't he do that? And you go, oops. Okay, let's try to deal with that. All right. So he'll also remind you periodically. Or sometimes Krishna in the heart will also say, you know, you're not properly situated. You're miserable. You're tired. You're drained. You're depressed. You're not happy. What are you doing in this, you know, move to another part of the company. So that will also be there. But we shouldn't be self-absorbed. We're supposed to be Krishna-absorbed. Am I rightly situated? Am I this? Am I that? Somebody else who hasn't said anything. Anybody else have something else? Because it's getting late.
I was listening to a lecture, and I can't remember who it was, but I think it was Chandramouli Swami.
Uh-huh.
Said a devotee went to Prabhupada and said, I've got too much service to do. And Prabhupada laughed so much he cried, because he said that's how you should be, though. See, you've got no time for anything else. So.
Yes?
What did Prabhupada mean?
We should be engaged in doing service 24 hours a day.
Mm. But
that it could be tiring. I mean, I don't live in a temple, but to me, I feel how tiring that could be.
Well, that means that you're not engaged in service according to your nature, then.
Mm. And do you mean maybe it wouldn't be in, say, my nature this life to do it 24 hours
no,
a day?
No, that's the nature of every soul is to serve Krishna 24 hours a day.
Oh. Mm.
But maybe that particular, you know, type of service, you need to find a type of service. There should be some variety in your day.
Mm.
It's also service to sit down and read Krishna book. That's also service. It's also service to take prasadam.
And to cook.
Service to
cook.
Mm-hmm. Service to make sure your body gets proper exercise. If you're taking care of the boss, if you're having to drive the boss's car, you know, you got to make sure it works. I mean, there are certain things that can't be service. You can't, you know, sell liquor or run a striptease club as service. But other than things like that, service is your mentality.
So executing a regular day job with detachment is a service?
With not just with personal detachment and with love is service, yes.
Mm. It's a difficult concept, that one, I find.
Yes, it is. I'm doing this for Krishna. Then you have to, of course, actually be doing it for Krishna. It's not just changing your way of thinking. But you start thinking about how Krishna's probably saying, think, Krishna's given me this job to do.
Okay.
How can I do it in a way that will please him?
Because he's put you in that position.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to. Okay.
Well, everybody has to do some work, he says in the Bhagavad Gita. You have to maintain your body with some work.
Mm.
Whether or not that work is service depends on your mood. That's why we say devotional service. And it's not that automatically someone in the temple who's externally doing service is really doing service and you're not. They may not be doing any service and you may be doing service. It depends on your mood. If someone's here just because the police were chasing them and they figure the police won't look in a Hare Krishna temple and all they're thinking about is how to steal stuff out of the treasury and how to get back out again, it may turn into service after a while. We've had that happen. Had that happen. That after a while people say, I like being in the Hare Krishna temple. But if while you're at your day job you're thinking that Krishna is your ability and Krishna is your intelligence and Krishna is the light of the sun and you see Krishna in the work that you're doing and you try to develop your abilities to glorify him and you use some of the money and the expertise or whatever, the fruits of your work, which are not just money, directly in glorifying him, then that's also service. Service doesn't mean that you have to live in an ashram and just wash the deity's plates. In one sense, when you're living in an ashram washing the deity's plates, you can become complacent and think, well, I'm doing service all day. And you forget about dealing with your heart. I like what Burajan Prabhu said, that bhakti is not a series of activities. It's a way of cleaning the heart. Now, if you have the mood that you can live in an ashram or live in a holy place and have the proper mentality, you have a big advantage. But if you're not suited for that life, then that's a disadvantage. Again, it depends on your nature. Nature may change during life. As far as that, there's two things, varna and ashram. So varna is pretty much the same during your life, your whole life.
Varna is
your occupation, what you do to make a living. And ashram is, are you a student? Are you a family person? Are you retired?
Mm.
So that changes during life.
Mm.
For everybody. Not just for Hare Krishna devotees. So that part of our nature changes. So it could be that, you know, when you're young, you want to have a job and you want to have a house. And then when you're older, you say, I want to retire and I want to live in an ashram. Was that okay?
Mm, yes, thank you.
Service is your mentality. I mean, again, you can't just do anything whimsically and say it's service. You can't say, well, I'm, you know, going to go chop off people's heads and offer them to Krishna. Krishna doesn't want severed heads. You can't, so you can't just do anything whimsically. It's got to be something that's ethical. But that's a pretty big option. You know, what you can offer in service is pretty wide. Prabhupada said it's not stereotyped or narrow. It's not that the only thing you can do in service is distribute books, or the only thing you can do in service is offer incense to the demons. It's very wide. So as long as you're within that boundary, which is a huge boundary, it's something like, you know, as long as you follow the government laws, you can do whatever occupation you want. So the government laws they allow for a lot of freedom of what you can do. Right? I mean, there's millions and millions of different things of work you can do and different ways you can live in the United Kingdom that are still within the government that don't violate the government laws. So similarly, as long as you're within the boundaries of the scripture, and that's huge, then whether or not it serves is a question of your mood. What's driving you? Is that okay? And everybody can do 100% service. Everybody. If you want to. Yes?
We've just started this program for the newcomers. We're trying to do it once every 2 weeks. And a lot of them are quite young. Some of them go to university. So we were told not to kind of tell them right at the beginning, you know, lay down the rules, this is what we do, and, you know, for the four principles, and that might scare them off. So I just wanted, we just wanted your advice how to go about
it. Well, I wish somebody had done that with me. It's one of my biggest regrets. I first visited a temple when I was 14, and I was brought there by a friend of a friend. His name was Bill Trengrove. Anyway, he'd been coming to the temple for a long time. It's a long story, but anyway, he ended up bringing me to the temple. And the first day I came, one devotee just spoke general philosophy to us, and I was very excited. I really liked it. And I remember saying to Bill on the way back, I said, you know, I really like it. I agree with everything she said. I said I couldn't repeat any of it, but I really made a lot of sense. Then we went the next week, we talked to another girl, and I said, what do I have to do to join? I wish she had told me about the four related principles of chanting Hare Krishna, man. She didn't. She said, well, we don't have any room in the ashram. You'd have to get your own apartment. I was 14 years old. Maybe she thought I was, like, with this guy. Maybe she thought I was 18 and with this guy. I mean, he wasn't even really a friend. He was, like, an acquaintance. I was only 14. So I thought, oh, I guess Krishna consciousness isn't practical. And I didn't go back to the temple for years. And one of the things that bothers me is that she didn't tell me. She didn't even say to be a vegetarian. She didn't say anything. Nothing. They sold me a book. They sold me Easy Journey to Other Planets. I read maybe 3 pages. I mean, after that, if people said, what do you believe in? I'd say, I believe in Hare Krishna. But I wish she had told me about the right little principles. It really bugs me that she didn't. I mean, having said that, I can't say that every time I talk to new people that I go through the regular principles. I try to remember to do that, but I don't always.
But isn't it, it's not that we should demand from them following it, but we can mention that
how
vegetarian...
How can you demand anything from anybody?
Yeah, so, but...
Can
but
you
we,
demand anything from anybody?
We can't.
No.
But we can at least mention that to practice spiritual life is good to be vegetarian, you know? It's
well,
not
you could just say that this is what we do.
Yeah, we practice.
You don't have to make a big deal out of it, but I think it should be mentioned. That's my opinion from my experience. I think it should be mentioned.
I was first told just do what you can do.
Yeah.
Just do what you can do.
Well, that, you can also say that to people.
Charm.
You can also say that to people, but it's nice that they know. So if somebody is willing to do more, at least they know what more they can do. You would say, you know, this would be very helpful. Those of us who've made a serious commitment, we take these vows, and whatever, you know, to whatever extent you can do this would be helpful. That Krishna consciousness isn't an all or nothing thing. That even if you just add 1% of it to your life, your quality of your life will improve. That you don't have to make a big, then it's a fact. Even if someone just reads a little bit of Bhagavad Gita once a week, their life will improve. Even if they just chant a little, even if they just become vegetarian and think about that they're doing it to please Krishna, their life will improve. Their health will improve. Right? So anything you can add will be beneficial.
Do you have any specific suggestions? We have like kirtan, prasadam, and discussions, some video. Do you have any other suggestions?
Be happy. People like happy people. I'd suggest also that, Indrajuna Swami was saying this last night, that the scripture, he was saying half and half. I don't know if I've ever worked out the percentage, but he was saying that like half the scripture talks about what's wrong with material life and half talks about what's wonderful about Krishna. Again, I'm not sure what the percentage is. But talking about personality, some people have a personality where they motivate themselves with good and some people motivate themselves with bad. It's like each of us tend to use more a carrot or a stick with our own self. I mean, we all use a combination, but we tend to prefer one or the other. Some of us are always telling ourselves what we've done wrong and hitting ourselves over the head to get ourselves to do something, and others of us are always celebrating what we did right to get ourselves to do. So they call that the toward or away from. That some people are more motivated by the positive and some are more motivated by the negative. By the way, one is not better than the other. And if you're extreme of either one, you're in a lot of trouble. If you're only motivated by positive all the way at the extreme, then you don't have any caution in your life. That means you never consider the negatives of anything. Those are the kind of people who are criminals and drug addicts. And it's not that one is better than the other. But recognizing that you're going to have a mix of those people that you're speaking to, you want to present some both of what's wonderful about spiritual life and what's bad about the material world. You want to have a mix. You want to make sure you always have a mix. Don't only talk about what's bad about the material world, and don't only talk about what's favorable about spiritual life. It should be some mix in every presentation. Because some of the people will only respond to one and some will only respond to the other. Or more respond to one than the other. Is that okay? Make it light, fun. Be happy yourself. Be a kind of person where people look at you and say, I'd like to be like that. That's the most important thing. It's the most important thing. And yeah, demanding. How can you demand anything of anybody? Yes?
No, I was going to say the same question. I was going to ask, do you think like feeding them like a proper plate of prasad and be part of the thing? Can we just give snacks?
Well, it depends how much money you want to spend.
So would it be okay to just keep snacks? You don't necessarily have to keep them.
Just make sure they're tasty and healthy. And if at all possible, it should be offered to the deities. If all possible, it should be cooked by first-class cooks and offered to the deities. Both for spiritual quality. But it's late. Thank you very much. I hope this was helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Is this all right?
Thank you very
and
much
hope that you get your study program together.
just give us your blessing.
It's not a question of blessing, it's a question of looking at your priorities.
Mm-hmm. Can we get a question?
All right?
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you very much for tolerating me.
Thank you.
For all these weeks.